What were they doing here, now, in my New York? I didn't know how to talk to either of them in the Rainbow Room, wasn't sure what our relation should be, or what, in this context, I owed or was due. I tried to imagine how Lamin was feeling right now, on the other side of the Matrix at last, and if he had someone to guide him through this bewildering new world, someone to help explain to him the obscene amounts of money that had here been expended on things like helium balloons and steamed squid buns and 400 peonies. But it was Amy at his side, not me. And she had no such concerns, I could see that from here. This was her world, and he had simply been invited into it, as she would have invited anyone else as a privilege and a gift, the same way queens once unself-consciously offered their patronage. In her mind, it was all fate, always meant to be, and therefore fundamentally uncomplicated. That's what I and Judy and Fern and all of us were being paid for, really. To keep life uncomplicated, for her. We waded through the tangled weeds so she might float over the surface.
Anyway, I was glad to come. I wanted to see you.
Fern reached over and brushed my right shoulder with his hand, and in the moment, I thought he was only removing some dust. My mind was elsewhere. I was stuck on this image of me caught in the weeds and Amy floating serenely over my head. Then his other hand went to my other shoulder. Still, I did not understand. Like everybody else at that party, except perhaps Fern himself, I could not take my eyes off Lamin and Amy.
My God, look at this!
Fern glanced over briefly to where I was pointing and caught Lamin and Amy as they exchanged a brief kiss. He nodded.
Ah, so they do not hide anymore.
Jesus Christ! Is she going to marry him? Is she going to adopt him?
Who cares? I don't want to talk about her.
Suddenly, Fern grabbed both my hands in his hands, and when I turned back, I found that he was staring at me with comic intensity.
Fern, what are you doing?
You pretend to be cynical.
He kept seeking my eyes as I tried equally hard to avoid his.
But I think you are just afraid.
In his accent, it sounded like a line from one of the Mexican telenovelas we used to watch with half the village, each Friday afternoon, in the school's TV room. I couldn't help it. I laughed. His eyebrows came together in a sad line.
Please don't laugh at me.
He looked down at himself, and I looked too. I think it was the first time I'd ever seen him out of cargo shorts.
The truth is, I don't know how to dress in New York.
I eased my hands from his. Fern, I don't know what you think this is. You really don't know me.
Well, you are hard to know well. But I want to know you. That is what it's like being in love. You want to know someone better.
It seemed to me that the situation was so awkward that he should just disappear at this point, just as such scenes in the telenovelas cut to a commercial, because otherwise I didn't see how we were going to get through the next 2 minutes. He didn't move. Instead, he grabbed 2 passing flutes of champagne from a waiter's tray and drank his down in one go.
You have nothing to say to me? I am offering you my heart.
Oh, my God, Fern, please. Stop talking like that. I don't want your heart. I don't want to be responsible for anybody else's heart, for anybody else's anything.
He looked confused.
A peculiar idea. Once you are alive in this world, you are responsible.
For myself.
Now I drank down a whole flute.
I just want to be responsible for myself.
Sometimes in this life you have to take risks on other people. Look at Amy.
Look at Amy?
Why not? You have to admire her. She's not ashamed. She loves this young man. It will probably mean a lot of trouble for her.
You mean for us?
It'll mean a lot of trouble for us. But she doesn't care what people think.
That's because, as usual, she has no idea what she's getting into. The whole thing is absurd.
They were leaning on each other, watching the magician, an engaging gentleman in a Savile Row suit and a bow tie who'd been at Jay's 8th birthday, too. He was doing the trick of the Chinese rings.
Light poured into the rainbow room, and the rings slipped in and out of each other despite their apparent solidity. Lamin looked mesmerized. Everybody did. I could hear, very faintly, Chinese prayer music, and understood, in the abstract, that this must be part of the effect. I could see what everyone was feeling, but I was not with them and could not feel it.
You are jealous?
I wish I could fool myself the way she can. I'm jealous of anyone that's oblivious. Little ignorance never stopped her. Nothing stops her. Fern emptied his glass and placed it awkwardly on the ground.
I should not have spoken.
I believe I have misinterpreted the situation. His love language had been very silly, but now that he returned to his more usual administrative language, I felt sorry. He turned and went back indoors. The magician finished. I watched Amy get up and approach the little, rounded stage. Jay was called up, or at least arrived at her side, and then Kara, and then Lamin. The whole party surrounded them in an adoring crescent shape. I seemed to be the only person still outside, looking in. With one arm she was hugging Jay and Kara. With the other she held up Lamin's left hand in triumphal pose. Everybody clapped and cheered, a muffled roar through the double-glazed glass. She held this position. A room full of cameras flashed. From where I stood, it was a pose that collapsed many periods in her life into one. Mother and lover, big sister, best friend, superstar and diplomat, billionaire and street kid, foolish girl and woman of substance. But why should she get to take everything, have everything, do everything, be everyone, in all places, at all times? 7. The thing I remember most vividly is the warmth of her body as she ran off stage and into the wings, into my arms, where I stood ready with a pencil skirt to replace her satin dress, or a black cat's tail to be pinned on her behind, once she had shimmied out of the pencil skirt, and clean tissues to wipe the sweat that always sprung from the bridge of her freckled nose. There were, of course, many other guys and dolls to whom I had to hand guns or canes, or fix a tie-pin, straighten a seam, or set a brooch just so. But it's Tracy I remember, holding onto my elbow for balance with one hand, and stepping lightly into a pair of bright green capri pants, which I then zipped up the side, taking care not to catch her skin, before kneeling down to tie the bows on her stack-heeled white taps. She was always serious and silent during these quick changes. She never giggled or fidgeted like the other hotbox girls, nor was she in any way self-doubting or in need of reassurance, as I soon learnt was typical of chorus girls, but alien to Tracy's nature. As I dressed or undressed her, she remained fixated upon whatever was happening on stage. If she could watch the show, she would. If she was stuck backstage in a changing room and listening to it over the monitors, she was so focused on what she was hearing that you couldn't engage her in conversation. It didn't matter how many times she saw that show, she'd never tired of it. She was always impatient to get back inside it. Everything backstage bored her. Her real life was out there, in that fiction, under the lights, and this confused me because I knew, as no one else in the cast did, that she was having a secret affair with one of the stars. A married man. He played Brother Arvide Abernathy, the kindly old gentleman who carries a bass drum in the Salvation Army band. They didn't need to spray any grey in his hair. He was almost 3 times Tracy's age and had plenty already. A salt and pepper afro that contributed to that air theatrical critics like to call distinguished. In real life, he was Kenyan-born and raised, followed by a stint at RADA, followed by another at the Royal Shakespeare Company. He had a very plummy Shakespearean speaking voice, which most people laughed at behind his back, but that I liked to hear, especially on stage. It was so luxuriant. Verbal velvet. Theirs was an affair conducted in little pockets of time, with no freedom to expand. On stage they had almost no scenes together. Their characters came from 2 different worlds, a house of prayer and a den of sin. While offstage, everything was clandestine and harried. But I was glad to take on the role of the intermediary, scouting out empty dressing rooms, keeping watch, lying for them when lying was required. It gave me something concrete to do with my time, instead of wondering, as I did most nights, what on earth I was doing there. Observing their affair was interesting to me, too, for it was curiously constructed. Every time the poor man caught sight of Tracy, he looked as if he might die of love for her, and yet she was never very kindly to him, as far as I could see, and I often heard her call him an old fool, or tease him about his white wife, or make cruel jokes about his aging libido. Once, I interrupted them by mistake, walking into a dressing room I didn't realize they were in, and found a singular scene. He was on his knees on the floor, fully dressed, but head bowed and frankly weeping, and she was sitting on a stool, her back to him, facing the mirror, applying some lipstick. "Please don't," I heard her say as I slammed the door shut. "And get up! Get up off your fucking knees!" Later, she told me he was offering to leave his wife. What was strangest to me about her ambivalence towards him was how severely it disturbed the hierarchies of the theatrical world she occupied, in which every soul in a production had a precise value and a corresponding power, and all relations conformed strictly to a certain schema. Socially, practically, sexually, a female star was worth all 20 chorus girls, for example, and hot box girl number one was worth about 3 chorus girls and all the understudies, while a male speaking part of any kind was equal to all the women on stage put together, except perhaps the female lead, and a male star could print his own currency. When he entered a room, it reformed around him. When he chose a chorus girl, she submitted to him at once. When he suggested a change, the director sat up in his seat and listened. This system was so solid it was unaffected by revolutions elsewhere. Directors had begun, for example, to cast across and against the old class and colour lines. There were black King Henrys and Cockney Richard III's and Kenyan Arvide Abernathys sounding just like Larry Olivier, but the old onstage hierarchies of rank remained firm as ever. In my first week, lost backstage and confused about the location of the prop cupboard, I stopped a pretty Indian girl in a corset who happened to be running by and tried to ask her for directions. "Don't ask me," she said without slowing down. "I'm nobody." Tracy's affair struck me as a form of revenge upon all that, like watching a house cat capture a lion, tame him, treat him like a dog. I was the only person the two lovers could socialize with after hours. They couldn't go to the Coach and Horses with the rest of the crew, but they had the same urge to drown a post-show adrenaline high in alcohol, so they went instead to the Colony Room, where nobody else from the show went, but where he had been a member for years. Often I was invited to go with them. Here everyone called him Chalky, and they knew his drink, whiskey and ginger ale, and it was always sitting on the bar waiting for him when he arrived on the dot at 10:45. He loved that, and the stupid nickname, because it was a posh English habit to give stupid nicknames, and he was devoted to all things posh and English. I noticed he hardly ever talked of Kenya or Africa. One night I tried to ask him about his home, but he became irritable.
"Look, you kids, you grow up here. You think where I come from it's all starving children and Live Aid or whatever the hell you think it is. Well, my father was a professor of economics. My mother is a government minister. I grew up in a very beautiful compound, thank you very much, with servants, a cook, a gardener."
He went on like this for a while and then returned to his preferred subject, the glory days of Soho. I felt embarrassed, but also that he had deliberately misunderstood me. Of course I knew his world existed. That kind of world exists everywhere. That wasn't what I'd wanted to know. His real allegiance was to the bar itself, which affection he struggled to translate to girls who had barely heard of Francis Bacon and saw only a narrow, smoke-stained room, the lurid green walls and the crazed clutter. "Art shit," Tracy called it, that took over every surface. To annoy her lover, Tracy liked to make a show of her ignorance, but though she tried to disguise it, I suspected she was often interested in the long, digressive, drunken stories he told about artists, actors and writers he had known, their lives and works, who they'd fucked and what they'd drunk or taken, and how they'd died. When he went to the toilet or out to buy fags, I sometimes caught her deep in contemplation of one nearby painting or another, following the movement, I thought, of the brush, looking intently with that sharpness she brought to all things. And when Chalky staggered back in and resumed his subject, she'd roll her eyes, but she was listening, I could tell. Chalky had known Bacon only a little, enough to raise a drink with, and they'd had a good friend in common, a young actor called Paul, a man of great beauty, great personal charm, the son of Ghanaians, who'd lived with his boyfriend and Bacon for a while in a platonic triangle down in Battersea.
"And the thing you have to understand," said Chalky,
after a certain number of whiskies, there were always these things we had to understand.
"The thing you have to understand is that here, in Soho, at that time, there was no black, there was no white. Nothing so banal. It wasn't like Brixton. No, here we were brothers, in art, in love."
He gave Tracy a squeeze.
"In everything. Then Paul got that part in A Taste of Honey. We came here to celebrate it, and everyone was talking about it, and we felt like we were the centre of the whole thing. Swinging London, bohemian London, literary London, theatrical London, that this was our country, too, now. It was beautiful. I tell you, if London began and ended on Dean Street, all would be happiness."
Tracy wriggled off his lap back onto her own stool. "You're fucking pissed," she muttered, and the barman, overhearing what she'd said, laughed and told her,
"'Fraid that's a condition of membership round here, love."
Chalky turned to Tracy and kissed her sloppily.
"Come, come, you wasp, if faith you are too angry."
"Look what I'm dealing with,"
cried Tracy, pulling him off her. Chalky had a fondness for dirge-like Shakespearean ballads. It drove Tracy up the green walls, in part because she was jealous of his beautiful voice, but also because when Chalky started singing of willow trees and faithless shrews, it was a reliable sign that he'd soon have to be half-carried down that steep and rickety staircase, heaved into a cab, and sent back to his white wife, his fare prepaid with money Tracy had lifted from his wallet, usually taking a bit more than was strictly required. But she was pragmatic. She only ended the night when she'd learnt something. I believe she was trying to pick up what she'd missed these past 3 years and I'd gained. A free education. The show was very well reviewed, and in November, backstage, 5 minutes before curtain, we were gathered together and told, by the producers, that our run was to be extended, past its Christmas deadline and into the spring. The cast was delighted, and that night they took their delight out with them on stage. I stood in the wings, happy for them, too, but with my own secret news tucked up inside me, which I hadn't yet told the management, or Tracy. One of my applications had come through, finally. A production assistant position, a paid internship at the newly launched British version of YTV. The previous week I'd gone for an interview, hit it off with my interviewer, who told me, a little unprofessionally, I thought, given the queue of girls outside, that I had the job, there and then. It was only 13 grand, but if I stayed at my father's it was more than enough. I was happy and yet hesitant to tell Tracy, without really asking myself what was at the root of my hesitancy. The hotbox girls dashed past me, fresh from makeup, and onto the stage, dressed as cats, with Adelaide front and centre and hotbox girl number one just to her left. They puffed up their chests provocatively, licked their paws, got a hold of their tails, one of which I had pinned on Tracy 10 minutes before, crouched like kittens about to pounce, and started to sing of mean paupers who, holding you too tightly, make you want to roam, and other gentle strangers who make you feel at home. It was always a riotous number, but that night it was a real sensation. From where I stood, with a clear view of the front row, I could see the undisguised lust in the eyes of the men, and how many of those eyes were drawn specifically to Tracy when they should have rightfully been on the woman playing Adelaide. Everyone else was eclipsed by the litheness of Tracy's legs in that leotard, the pure vitality of her movements, truly cat-like, ultra-feminine in a mode I envied and could not hope to create in my own body, no matter how many tails you stuck on me. There were 13 women dancing in that number, but only Tracy's movements really mattered. And when she ran off stage with the rest, and I told her how wonderfully she danced, she did not, like the other girls, second-guess me or ask for any repetition of the praise. She only said, "Yes, I know," bent over, stripped, and handed me her balled-up tights. That night, the cast celebrated at the Coach and Horses.
Tracy and Chalky went with them, and so did I, but we were so used to the drunken and intimate intensity of the colony room, also to our own seats and to hearing ourselves speak, and after about 10 minutes of standing, screaming at the top of our voices, and not getting served, Tracy wanted to leave. I thought she meant back to the colony room, with Chalky, to do as we usually did, so she and her lover could drink too much and go over their impossible situation, his wish to tell his wife, her determination that he would not, the complication of his children who were around our age, and the possibility, dreaded by Chalky but unlikely, I thought, that the papers might find out and make some kind of story of it. But when he went to the bathroom, Tracy pulled me outside and said, "I don't want to do him tonight." I remember that do. "Let's just go back to yours and get caned." It was about 11:30 when we got to Kilburn. Tracy had rolled one on the train, and now we smoked walking down the street, remembering the times we'd performed this same action down the same road, aged 20, 15, 13, 12. As we walked, I told her my news. It sounded very glamorous. YTV, 3 letters from a world that had preoccupied us as teenagers, and I felt almost embarrassed to bring it up, obscenely lucky, as if I were about to be on the channel rather than filling its British post and brewing its British tea. Tracy stopped walking and took the joint from me. "But you're not going to leave right now, in the middle of a run." I shrugged and confessed, "Tuesday, are you really fucked off?" She didn't reply. We walked in silence for a bit, and then she said, "You planning on moving out as well, or what?" I wasn't. I'd found I liked living with my father, and being near, but not in the same space as, my mother. To my own surprise, I was in no hurry to leave. And I remember making a lot of this to Tracy, of how much I loved the old neighbourhood, wanting to impress her, I suppose, prove how firmly my feet were still on the local ground, notwithstanding any change in my fortunes. I still lived with my father as she lived with her mother. She listened, smiled in a tight sort of way, lifted her nose in the air and kept her counsel. A few minutes later, we reached my father's and I realized I didn't have my key. I often forgot it, but didn't like to ring the bell in case he was already asleep, knowing he had to be up early. So I would go down the side return and let myself in the back kitchen, which was usually open. But at that moment, I was finishing the joint and didn't want to risk my father seeing me. We had recently promised each other we'd stop smoking. So I sent Tracy. A minute later, she came back and said the kitchen was locked and we'd better go to hers. The next day was a Saturday. Tracy left early for the matinee, but I didn't work Saturdays. I went back to my father's flat and spent the afternoon with him. I didn't see the letter that day, though it might already have been on the mat. I found it on the Sunday morning. It had been pushed through my door and was addressed to me, handwritten, with a little food stain on the corner of one page, and I think of it as the last truly personal written letter I ever received. For even though Tracy had no computer, not yet, the revolution was happening all around us, and soon enough the only paper addressed to me would come from banks, utilities, or the government, with a little plastic window to warn me of the contents. This letter came with no warning. I hadn't seen Tracy's handwriting in years, and I opened it as I sat at my father's table with my father sitting opposite me.
"Who's that from, then?"
he asked. And for a few lines I still didn't know myself. 2 minutes later, the only question remaining was whether it was fact or fiction. It had to be fiction. To believe otherwise was to make everything in my present life impossible, as well as destroying much of the life I had led up to this point. It was to allow Tracy to place a bomb under me and blow me to smithereens. I read it again to make sure I had understood. She began by speaking of her duty, and of it being a horrible duty, and that she had asked and asked herself, asked spelt wrong, what to do, and had felt she had no choice, choice spelt wrong. She described Friday night as I, too, remembered it. Walking up the street to my father's, smoking a joint, up to the point where she went down the side return to let herself in via the kitchen, unsuccessfully. But here the timeline broke in two, into her reality and mine, or her fiction,
as far as I was concerned, and my fact. In her version, she walked round the back of my father's flat, stood in the small gravel courtyard, and then, because the kitchen seemed to be locked, took two steps to the left and brought her nose right up to the back window, to my father's bedroom window, the one in which I slept, cupped her hands upon the glass and looked in. There she saw my father, naked, on top of something, moving up and down, and at first she had naturally thought it was a woman, and if it had been a woman, or so she assured me, then she never would have mentioned it. It was none of her business or mine. But the fact was, it was not a woman at all. It was a doll, human-sized, but inflated, and of very dark complexion. "Like a gollywog," she wrote, with a crescent of synthetic lamb's wool hair and a huge pair of bright red lips, red as blood. "You all right, love?" asked my father across the table, as I held that comic, tragic, absurd, heartbreaking, hideous letter shaking in my hand. I said I was fine, took Tracy's letter to the back courtyard, took out a lighter, and set it on fire. Part 7. Late Days. 1. I didn't set eyes on Tracy again for 8 years. It was an unseasonably warm May evening, the night I went out with Daniel Kramer, a first date. He came to the city quarterly and was one of Amy's favourites in the sense that he did not, by virtue of being handsome, meld entirely with all the other accountants and financial advisers and copyright lawyers she regularly consulted, and so in her mind had been granted things like a name, qualities like a good aura and a New York sense of humour, and a few biographical details she had managed to recall. Originally from Queens, attended Stuyvesant, plays tennis. Trying to keep the arrangements as loose as possible, I had suggested to him that we go to Soho and play it by ear, but Amy wanted us to come first to the house for a drink. It wasn't common at all, this kind of casual, intimate invitation, but Kramer didn't seem surprised or alarmed to receive it. The 20 minutes we were granted passed with no customer-like behaviour. He admired the art without overdoing it, listening politely as Amy repeated all the things the dealer who sold the art to her had told her about the art when she bought it, and soon enough we were free of Amy, of the oppressive grandeur of that house, skipping down the back stairs, both a little giddy on good champagne, emerging onto the Brompton Road and into a warm, close night, muggy, threatening a storm. He wanted to take the long walk into town. We had vague plans to see what was on at the Curzon, but I was not a tourist, and those were my salad days of impossible heels. I was about to look for a taxi when, for fun, he stepped off the curb and waved down a passing pedicab. "She collects a lot of African art," he said, as we climbed into the leopard print seats. He was only making conversation, but primed against any hint of a customer, I cut him down. "Well, I don't really know what you can mean by African art." He looked surprised by my tone, but managed a neutral smile. He relied on Amy's business, and I was an extension of Amy. "Most of what you saw," I began in a tone better suited for a lecture hall, "is actually Augusta Savage, So Harlem. It's where she lived when she first came to New York. I mean, Amy. Of course, she's a great supporter of the arts generally." Now Kramer looked bored. I was boring myself. We didn't speak again until the bike stopped at the corner of Shaftesbury Avenue and Greek Street. As we pulled up at the curb, we were surprised by the existence of a Bangladeshi boy, whose independent reality we had, up to that point, entirely forgotten, but who had undeniably brought us this far, and now turned round on his bike seat, his face soaked with sweat, hardly able to explain, through gasps, how much this form of human toil cost per minute. There was nothing we wanted to see at the cinema. In a slightly tense mood, our clothes sticking to us in the heat, we wandered towards Piccadilly Circus, without knowing which bar we were heading for or whether we should eat instead, both already considering the evening a failure, looking straight ahead and confronted every few steps with the giant playbills of the theatres. It was in front of one of these, a little way down, that I stopped dead. A performance of the musical Showboat, a shot of the Negro chorus. Head handkerchiefs, rolled up trousers, aprons and work skirts, but all done tastefully, carefully, authentically, with no hint of Mammy or Uncle Ben about it. And the girl closest to the camera, her mouth open wide in song, with one arm stretched high above her head, clutching a broom, the very picture of kinetic joy, was Tracy. Kramer came up behind me to peer over my shoulder. I pointed a finger at Tracy's upturned nose, as Tracy herself used to point at a dancer's face as it passed across our TV screens. I know her.
Oh, yeah?
I know her really well. He tapped a cigarette out of a packet, lit it, and looked the theatre up and down.
Well, you want to go see it?
But you don't like musicals, do you? Nobody serious does. He shrugged.
I'm in London. It's a show. That's what your men do in London, isn't it? Go see a show?
He passed me his cigarette, pushed open the heavy doors, and headed to the box office. It all of a sudden seemed very romantic and coincidental and well-timed, and I had a ridiculous girlish narrative running in my head of a future moment in which I would be explaining to Tracy, backstage somewhere in some sad regional theatre as she pulled on a pair of tired old fishnets, that the very moment I realized I'd met my love, the moment I came into my true happiness, was the same moment I happened to spot her, quite by chance, in that very small role she'd had back in the day in the chorus of Showboat, all those years and years ago. Kramer came back out with two tickets, great seats in the second row. In lieu of dinner, I bought myself a huge bag of chocolates, of the kind I rarely got to eat, Amy considering such things not only nutritionally fatal, but clear evidence of moral weakness. Kramer bought two large plastic tumblers of bad red wine and the program. I searched through it, but couldn't find Tracy. She wasn't where she should be in the alphabetical list of the cast, and I started to worry that I was suffering from some kind of delusion or had made an embarrassing error. I flicked the pages back and forth, sweat breaking out of my forehead. I must have looked crazy.
"You okay?"
asked Kramer. I was almost at the end of the program again when Kramer pressed a finger to a page to stop me turning it.
"But isn't that your girl?"
I looked again. It was. She'd changed her common-sounding, barbarous last name, the name by which I'd always known her, to the Frenchified and, to me, absurd, Leroy. Her first name, too, had been adapted. Now it was Tracy, with two E's, instead of a Y. And in the picture, her hair was straight and glossy. I laughed out loud. Kramer looked at me curiously.
And you're good friends?
I know her very well. I mean, I haven't seen her in about 8 years. Kramer frowned.
See, in guy world, we'd call that an ex-friend. Or better still, a stranger.
The orchestra started up. I was reading Tracy's bio, parsing it furiously, in a race against time before the house lights dimmed, as if the visible words were hiding another set, with a far deeper meaning that required decoding, and would reveal something essential about Tracy and the way her life was now. Tracy Leroy. Chorus, Dahomey Dancer. Theatre includes Guys and Dolls, Wellington Theatre. Easter Parade, UK Tour. Greece, UK Tour. Fame, Scottish National Theatre. Anita, West Side Story, Workshop. If it was the story of her life, it was disappointing. It lacked the ubiquitous accomplishments of all the other bios. No TV, no film, and no mention of where she'd been trained, which I took to mean she'd never graduated. Apart from Guys and Dolls, there was no other West End work, only those bleak-sounding tours. I imagined small church halls and rowdy schools, empty matinees on the stages of abandoned cinemas, minor local drama festivals. But if some part of all this pleased me, another part, equally large, was incensed at the idea that this bio of Tracy Leroy could be fairly compared, by any of the people in the theatre presently reading it, or by any of the actors in the cast,
with any of these other stories? What did Tracy Leroy have to do with these people? With this girl right next to her in the program, the girl with the endless biography, Emily Wolfe Pratt, who had studied at RADA and who couldn't know, as I did, the huge statistical unlikelihood of my friend standing on this stage, or any stage at all, in any role, in any context, and who perhaps had the temerity to think that she, Emily Wolfe Pratt, was a true friend of Tracy's, just because she saw her every night, just because they danced together, when in fact she hadn't the slightest idea of who Tracy was, or where she had come from, or how much it had cost her to get here. I turned my attention to Tracy's headshot. Well, I had to admit it. She turned out rather well. Her nose didn't seem so much of an outrage anymore. She'd grown into it. And the cruelty I'd always detected in her face was obscured by the megawatt Broadway smile she had in common with every other actor on the page. The surprise wasn't that she was pretty or sexy. She had already been in possession of these attributes as a very young teenager. The surprise was how elegant she had become. Her Shirley Temple dimples were gone, along with any hint of the provocative fleshiness she'd carried around as a child. It was almost impossible for me to imagine her voice, as I'd known it, as I remembered it, coming out of this pert-nosed, slick-haired, delicately freckled creature. I smiled down at her. Tracy Leroy, who are you pretending to be now?
Here we go,
said Kramer, as the curtain parted. He placed his elbows on his knees, his hands in two childish fists under his chin, and made a facetious face. I am agog. Stage left, a southern oak, draped in Spanish moss, beautifully rendered. Stage right, the suggestion of a Mississippi town. Center stage, a showboat in harbor, the Cotton Blossom. Tracy, along with four other women, was first on stage, appearing from behind the oak, holding her broom, and behind her came the men with their various hoes and spades. The orchestra played the opening bars of a song. I recognized it as soon as I heard it, the big chorus number, and at once felt a panic, without knowing why. It took a moment, until the music itself prompted the memory. I saw the whole song laid out on the old sheet music, and remembered, too, how I'd felt the first time I saw it. And now the lyrics, shocking to me as a child, formed in my mouth, in perfect time with the orchestra's preamble. I remembered the Mississippi, where the niggers all work, where the white people don't, and I gripped the armrest and felt an urge to rise up out of my seat. It was like a scene in a dream, with the idea of stopping Tracy before she even started. But as soon as I'd had the thought, it was already too late. And over the lyrics I'd thought I knew some new words that had been substituted. But of course they had. No one had sung the original words for years and years. Here we all work. Here we all work. I sank back into the seat. I watched Tracy expertly maneuver her broom this way and that, giving it life, so that it seemed almost another human presence on the stage, like the trick a stair pulls with that hat rack in the royal wedding. At one point she was perfectly aligned with the image from the poster, broom in the air, arm outstretched, kinetic joy. I wanted to pause her there in that position forever. The real stars arrived on stage to begin the drama. In the background, Tracy swept the front step of a general store. She was stage left from the main characters, Julie Laverne and her devoted husband, Steve, two cabaret actors who work together on the Cotton Blossom and are in love. But Julie Laverne is soon revealed, just before the interval, to be Julie Dozier, that is, not a white woman, as she's always pretended, but really a tragic mulatto who passes, who convinces everybody, including her own husband, until the day she's found out. At which point the couple are threatened with prison, for their marriage is illegal under the miscegenation laws. Steve cuts Julie's palm and drinks a little of her blood, the one-drop rule. They're both Negroes now. In the dim light, in the middle of this ridiculous melodrama, I checked the bio of the actress playing Julie. She had a Greek last name and was no darker than Kramer. During the interval, I drank a lot, and too quickly, and talked to Kramer relentlessly. I was leaning against the bar, blocking other people's routes to the bar staff, waving my hands around and ranting about the injustice of the casting, of how few roles there were for actors like me, and even when such roles did exist, you couldn't get them. Somebody always gave them to a white girl. For even a tragic mulatto apparently wasn't quite fit to play a tragic mulatto, even in this day and... Actors like you? What? You said actors like me. No, I didn't. Yeah, you did. My point is, that role should be Tracy's. Well, you just said she can't sing. From what I've seen, it's pretty much a singing role. She sings fine! Jesus! Why are you shouting at me? We sat through the second half as silent as we had been in the first, but this time the silence had a new texture, chilled with the iciness of mutual contempt. I longed to get out of there. Long stretches of the show passed without any sign of Tracy and held no interest for me. Only towards the end did the chorus reappear, this time as the Dahomey dancers, that is, as Africans from the Kingdom of Dahomey. They were supposedly performing at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. I watched Tracy in the circle of women, the men danced opposite in their own circle, swinging her arms, crouching low, and singing in a fictional African tongue, while the men stamped their feet and banged their spears in reply. Gunga, Hungo, Bunga, Guba. I thought unavoidably of my mother, and of her line in Dahomey stories, the proud history of the kings, the shape and feel of the cowrie shells used as money, the Amazon battalion made up solely of women, taking prisoners of war as slaves for the kingdom, or else simply severing their enemies' heads and holding them up in their hands. The way other children hear tell of Red Riding Hood and Goldilocks, I heard of this Black Sparta, the noble kingdom of Dahomey, fighting to hold off the French to the very end. But it was almost impossible to reconcile these memories with the farce presently happening, both on stage and off, for most of the people I sat among did not know what came next in the show, and consequently, I realized, they felt they were watching some kind of shameful minstrel show and were willing the scene to end. On stage, too, the audience at the World's Fair backed away from the Dahomey dancers, though not out of shame, but their own sense of fear, that these dancers were perhaps vicious, no different from the rest of their tribe, their spears not props, but weapons. I looked over at Kramer. He was squirming. I turned back and watched Tracy. What great fun she was having with the general discomfort, just as she had always enjoyed such moments as a child. She waved her spear and roared, marching with the rest, towards the fearful audience at the fair, and then laughed with the others as their audience ran off stage. Left to their own devices, the Dahomey dancers cut loose. They sang of how glad and tired they were, glad to see the back of the white folks, and tired, so tired of being in a Dahomey show. And now the audience, the real audience, understood. They saw that what they were watching was intended to be funny, ironic, that these were American dancers, not Africans. Yes, finally they grasped that a trick had been played on them. These folks weren't from Dahomey at all. They were just good old Negroes, after all, straight from Avenue A in New York City itself. Kramer chuckled, the music turned to ragtime, and I felt my feet moving beneath me, trying to echo on the plush red carpet the complicated soft-shoe shuffle Tracy was performing right above me on the hardwood stage. The steps were familiar to me. They would have been to any dancer, and I wished I was up there with her. I was stuck in London in the year 2005, but Tracy was in Chicago in 1893, and Dahomey 100 years before that, and anywhere and any time that people have moved their feet like that. I was so jealous, I cried. Show over, I came out of the long queue for the ladies and spotted Kramer before he saw me. He was standing in the lobby, bored and angry, holding my coat over his arm. Outside, it had started to lash with rain. "So, I'm gonna go," he said, passing me my coat, barely able to look at me. "I'm sure you'll want to go say hello to your friend." He turned his collar up and walked into that horrible evening, umbrella-less, still angry. Nothing offends a man so much as being ignored. But I was impressed. His dislike of me was so clearly stronger than any fear of my influence over his employer. Once he was out of sight, I walked around to the side of the theatre and found it was just as you always see it in the old movies. The door said, "Stage door," and there was a reasonable crowd of people waiting for the cars to emerge, despite the rain, clutching their little notepads and pens. With no umbrella, I pressed against the side of the wall, facing out, just covered by a narrow awning. I didn't know what I planned to say or how I was going to approach her, but I was just beginning to think about it when a car pulled up in the alleyway, driven by Tracy's mother. She was hardly changed. Through the rain-streaked windscreen, I could see the same tin hoops in her ears, the triple chin, hair scraped back tight, a cigarette hanging from her mouth. I turned at once to the wall and, as she parked, made my escape. I ran down Shaftesbury Avenue, getting soaked, thinking about what I'd seen in the back of that car. Two sleeping young children strapped in their seats. I wondered whether this, and nothing else, was the true reason the story of Tracy's life took so little time to read. 2. You want to believe there are limits to what money can make happen, lines it can't cross. Lamin in that white suit in the Rainbow Room felt like an example of the opposite lesson. But in fact, he didn't have a visa. Not yet. He had a new passport and a date of return. And when it was time to leave, I would accompany him back to the village, along with Fern, staying on a week to complete the yearly report for the board of the foundation. After which Fern would remain, and I'd fly to London to meet the children and supervise their quarterly visits to their fathers. So we were informed by Judy. Until then, a month together in New York. For the past decade, whenever we were in the city, my base had been the maid's room, on the ground floor, off the kitchen, although occasionally a half-hearted discussion would take place about the possibility of a separate space, a hotel, a rental somewhere, which never led to anything and was soon forgotten. But this time, an apartment had been rented for me before I even arrived, a two-bedroom on West 10th Street, high ceilings, fireplaces, the whole second floor of a beautiful brownstone. Emma Lazarus had once lived here. A blue plaque under my window memorialized her huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. My view was of a pink-blush dogwood in full bloom. I mistook all this for an upgrade. Then Lamin appeared, and I understood I'd been moved out so he could move in.
"What exactly is going on with you?"
Judy asked me, the morning after Jay's birthday party. No preliminaries, just her strident yell coming at me through my phone as I tried to tell the bodega guy on Mercer to skip the apple in my green juice.
"Have you had some kind of argument with Fernando? Because we just can't have him in the house right now. There's no room for him at the inn. We've got a full inn, as you probably noticed. Our lovebirds want their privacy. The plan was meant to be he'd stay with you for a few weeks in the apartment. It was all settled. Now he's suddenly resistant."
"Well, I wouldn't know anything about that, because nobody told me. Judy, you didn't even mention to me that Fern was coming to New York." Judy made a sound of impatience.
"Look, it was something Amy wanted me to handle. It had to do with accompanying Lamin over here. She didn't want it out in the world. It was delicate, and I handled it."
"Do you handle who I live with, too, now?"
"Oh, love. I'm sorry. Are you paying rent?"
I managed to get her off the phone and called Fern. He was in a taxi somewhere on the West Side Highway. I could hear the foghorn of a cruise ship docking.
"Better I find somewhere else. Yes, it's better. This afternoon I look at a place in..."
I heard papers being sadly shuffled.
"Well, it doesn't matter. Midtown somewhere."
"Fern, you don't know this city, and you don't want to pay rent here, believe me. Take the room. I'll feel shitty about it if you don't. I'll be at Amy's day and night. She's got that show in 2 weeks. We'll be up to our ears. I promise you, you'll hardly see me."
He closed a window. The river wind stopped rushing in. The quiet was unhelpfully intimate.
I like to see you.
Oh, Fern, please just take the room.
That evening, the only sign of him was an empty coffee cup in the kitchen and a tall canvas rucksack, the kind a student packs for a year off, leaning in the doorframe of his empty room. As he'd climbed the stairs of the ferry with his single bag on his back, Fern's simplicity, his frugality, had seemed to have something noble in it. I'd aspired to it, but here in Greenwich Village, the idea of a 45-year-old man with a single rucksack to his name struck me as merely sad and eccentric. I knew he'd crossed Liberia, alone and on foot, aged only 24. It was some kind of homage to Graham Greene. But now all I could think was, "Brother, this city will eat you alive." I wrote a pleasant and neutral note of welcome, tucked it under the straps of his bag, and went to bed. I was right about barely seeing him. I had to be at Amy's for 8 each morning. She woke daily at 5 to exercise for 2 hours in the basement, followed by an hour of meditation. And Fern always slept in, or pretended that he did. In Amy's townhouse, all was frantic planning, rehearsal, anxiety. The new show was in a mid-size venue. She'd be singing live, with a live band, things she hadn't done in years. To keep out of the line of fire, the meltdowns, the arguments, I stayed as much as I could in the office and avoided rehearsals whenever possible. But I gathered some kind of West African theme was afoot. A set of atumpan drums were delivered to the house, and a long-necked kora, swathes of kente and, one fine Tuesday morning, a 12-person dance troupe, African by the way of Brooklyn, who were taken to the basement studio and didn't emerge till after dinner. They were young, mostly second-generation Senegalese, and Lamin was fascinated by them. He wanted to know their last names and the villages of their parents, chasing down any possible connection of family or location. And Amy was glued to Lamin. You couldn't talk to her alone anymore. He was there at all times. But which Lamin was it? She thought it very provocative and funny to tell me he still prayed 5 times a day in her walk-in closet, which apparently faced Mecca. Personally, I wanted to believe in this continuity, in this part of him still beyond her reach, but there were days I barely recognized him. One afternoon, I brought a tray of coconut waters down to the studio and found him, in his white shirt and white slacks, demonstrating a move I recognized from the Kankerang, a combination of sidestamp, shuffle, and dip. Amy and the other girls watched him carefully and repeated the movements. They were sweating, dressed in crop tops and ripped unitards, and were pressed so closely to him and each other that each movement he made looked like a single wave passing through 5 bodies. But the truly unrecognizable gesture was the one that swept a bottle of coconut water from my tray without a thank you, without the vaguest acknowledgement. You'd have thought he'd been taking drinks from the wobbling trays of serving girls every day of his life. Maybe luxury is the easiest matrix to pass through. Maybe nothing is easier to get used to than money. Though there were times when I saw a haunted quality in him, like he was being stalked by something. Wandering into the dining room towards the end of his visit, I found him still at the breakfast table, talking at Granger, who looked very weary, as if he'd been there a long time. I sat down with them. Lamin's eyes were fixed somewhere between Granger's shaved head and the opposite wall. He was whispering again, a perplexing, uninflected speech that ran on like an incantation. "And right now, our women are sowing the onions in the right-hand beds, and then the peas in the left-hand beds. And if the peas are not irrigated in the correct way, then when they will come to rake the ground, about 2 weeks from now, they will have a problem. There will be an orange curl to the leaf. And if it has this curl, then it has the blight, and then they will dig up what has been sown and re-sow the beds, making sure, I hope, to put a layer of this rich soil we get from upriver. You see, when the men go upriver, about a week from now, when we travel up there, we get the rich soil."
"Uh-huh," Granger was saying,
every other sentence.
Uh-huh.
Fern made sporadic appearances in our lives, at board meetings or when Amy required his presence to deal with practical problems related to the school. He looked pained at all times, physically winced whenever we made eye contact, and advertised his misery wherever he went, like a man in a comic with a black cloud above his head. In front of Amy and the rest of the board, he gave a pessimistic update, focused on recent aggressive statements of the president's concerning foreign presence in the country. I'd never heard him talk like that before. So fatalistically, it was not really in his character, and I knew I was the true, oblique target of his critique. That afternoon, in the apartment, instead of hiding in my room as usual, I confronted him in the hall. He'd just come back from a run, sweating, bent over with his hands on his knees, breathing hard, looking up at me from under thick brows. I was very reasonable. He didn't speak, but seemed to take it all in. Without his glasses, his eyes looked enormous, like a cartoon baby's. When I finished, he straightened up and bent the other way, pushing the small of his back forward with both hands.
"Well, I apologize if I embarrassed you. You are right. It was unprofessional."
"Fan, can't we be friends?"
"Of course. But you also want me to say, I am happy we are friends?"
"I don't want you to be unhappy."
"But this is not one of your musicals. The truth is, I am very sad. I wanted something, I wanted you, and I didn't get at all what I wanted or hoped, and now I am sad. I will get over it, I suppose, but for now, I am sad. Is it okay for me to be sad?"
"Yes."
"Well, now I shower."
It was very difficult for me, at the time, to understand a person who spoke like that. It was alien to me, as an idea. I hadn't been raised that way. What response could such a man, the type who gives up all power, possibly expect from a woman like me? I didn't go to the show. Couldn't face it. I did not want to stand in the bleachers with Fern, feeling his resentment while watching Funhouse versions of the dances we had both seen at their source. I told Amy I was going, and I intended to go, but when 8 o'clock rolled around, I was still in my house sweats, lying half propped up on my bed with my laptop over my groin, and then it was 9 o'clock, and then it was 10. I absolutely had to go. My mind kept repeating this fact to me, and I was in agreement with it, but my body, freeze-framed, felt heavy and immovable. Yes, I must go. That was clear, and just as clear was the fact I was not going anywhere. I got on YouTube, skipped from dancer to dancer, Bojangles up the stairs, Harold and Fayard on a piano, Jenny Lagon in her swishing grass skirt, Michael Jackson at Motown 25. I often ended up at this clip of Jackson, although this time, as he moonwalked across the stage, the thing that really interested me was not the crowd's ecstatic screams or even the surreal fluidity of his movements, but the shortness of his trousers. And still the option of going did not seem lost or completely closed until I looked up from my aimless surfing and found 11:45 had happened, which signified we were now in the undeniable past tense. I hadn't gone. Search Amy, search venue, search Brooklyn Dance Troupe, image search, AP wire search, blog search. At first, simply out of a sense of guilt, but soon enough with a realization that I could reconstruct 140 characters at a time, image by image, blog post by blog post, the experience of having been there, until, by 1 a.m, nobody could have been there more than me. I was far more there than any of the people who had actually been there. They were restricted to one location and one perspective, to one stream of time. Whereas I was everywhere in that room at all moments, viewing the thing from all angles in a mighty act of collation. I could have stopped there. I had more than enough to give a detailed account of my evening to Amy in the morning, but I didn't stop. I was compelled by the process to observe in real